Did you know that Byers Airport Subaru is the oldest Subaru retailer in the entire country? And we're conveniently located right by the airport. Start your journey today at columbussubaru.com. Byers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're going in search of lost time as we discuss the life and work of Marcel Proust and explore his extraordinary connections with Ireland. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're going in search of the Irish Proust. In Search of Lost Time, published between 1913 and 1927, is a seven-volume book that transformed the modern novel with its extraordinary exploration of memory, time and consciousness, and leaving a remarkable imprint on Irish literature, from Samuel Beckett's early study of Proust to John McGarren's fiction, his influence runs deep. Despite this, during the Second World War in Ireland, parts of his masterpiece were banned as indecent. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore how a novel has changed how we understand time, consciousness and the act of remembering itself, and how he reshaped Irish literature. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Max McGuinness is the Research Ireland Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of French at Trinity College Dublin and is the co-editor with Michael Cronin of the brilliant new book The Irish Proust, Cultural Crossings from Beckett to McGarren, and he's also the theatre critic for The Irish Times. Professor Patrick O'Donovan, Paddy O'Donovan, is Emeritus Professor of French at University College Cork and a leading scholar of French literature and thought, with a particular interest in Proust and modernity, and he was also the founding chairperson of the Irish Humanities Alliance. Professor Barry McRae is the Donald R. Keogh Family Professor of Irish Studies and Professor of English, Irish Language and Literature at the University of Notre Dame, as well as a novelist and scholar of comparative literature. Dr. Richard Robinson is Associate Professor in the Department of Literature, Media and Language at Swansea University and the founding director of the Creative and Critical Practice Research Group, and his books include John McGahern and Modernism. Well, you're all very welcome. And Paddy, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question about, you know, this brilliant new book is called The Irish Proust, but I wonder, is Proust the French Joyce?
Well, thank you very much, Patrick. That's a great question to start us off with. In some ways, you know, the French Joyce would be Édouard Dujardin, the author of Les Lauriers sont coupés, to whom Joyce, you know, pays tribute and whom Joyce cites as a source. Joyce was about 10 or so years younger than Proust, so they weren't from identical generations. While Joyce certainly read Proust, we can be fairly confident that Proust didn't read Joyce. At one point in my essay in the book, I refer to Joyce, Proust and Wolfe as modernist siblings, and there are real points of affinity between them and points of contact. But there are great differences. So I think they're ill-assorted siblings in lots of ways.
And Paddy, tell us about Proust. Who was he and how good a writer was he? And one thing that intrigued me was the fact that so many of the volumes, such an incredible work he produced, I think over a million words, multiple volumes, I think seven volumes. And then the fact that so many were published posthumously, it's just this incredible production.
Yes. Well, Proust was born in 1871. And he belonged to a middle-class family. His mother's family, who were Jewish, were a wealthy family. And his father, who was a doctor, had achieved, if you like, Republican social promotion through education. He was a talented person from the countryside and made a very successful career in Paris. Proust was born at the time of the Paris Commune. And he never had great health. So that's an important thing about him. And he didn't live a terribly long life. He died in his early 50s, But from an early point in his life, even when he began to write his novel, he did feel the shadow of death about him. He was clearly a very clever young man, did very well at school, threw himself into reading and writing from an early age, and had attempted a novel with an autobiographical flavour again as a young man during what was really the most worldly period of his life, when he frequented Paris salon, went to fashionable holiday resorts on the coast and so on, travelled to Venice once, twice in fact, in the same year. But then following the death of his parents and his move to a new apartment, he began to return to writing. And one of the key things that happens is that he switches to writing in the first person and finds a way through various experimental efforts in 1907 and 1908 to constructing a possible framework for a very extended narrative. The subject of his book is really the story of a young man who dreams of being a writer. Through much of his life, he fails to find a way of realising that ambition until at the very end he realises that his own life could be the substance of a book. And in a way, that is Proust's own story. Between 1907, 1908, 1909, he's trying to find his way. He embarks on various experiments until finally he hits on a way of writing this novel in the first person. And from the very beginning, when he's writing to potential publishers, he describes this as a many-stranded novel, a novel about Paris, a novel about love, a novel about sexuality, a novel about all of the strata of society, high society in particular, a novel about the arts. So that conception is there from the very beginning. And he also has an idea of how the novel would end, as I've said, because the end of the novel is going to be the great revelation about how his own life story could be the substance of a book. So that's set out quite early on. And, you know, between 1909 and the war, he's writing intensively. And he didn't write in a very linear fashion. He would write different episodes, not in any particular order, and often revise them. In that he's very like Joyce. But by the time of the war, he has published one volume. In English, we call it Swan's Way or The Way by Swan. And he has an idea of how the whole novel will fall into place. But of course, during the war, he's not in a position to publish anymore. And at that time, we can talk further about this, the novel doubles in size between 1914 and his death in 1922. The novel doubles in size. It takes quite a new direction. The plot is reorganized from the middle outwards, though it reaches the same end point of the great revelation that he has now the subject of his book, though this is accompanied by a growing sense of the imminence of death and the possibility that the contingency of death would preclude him from realising his great vision. So that's a quick snapshot of his life and work.
A wonderful snapshot. And when he died in 1922, was he hailed as a genius, or did it take time before his genius was recognised?
Well, he had great difficulty publishing the novel. And in this way, his circumstances are a little bit different from Joyce. Before Joyce published Ulysses, he was already a published author. He attracted support from all kinds of well-known writers who were a generation older than him or of his own generation. He enjoyed sponsorship. He was able to publish segments of his novel in reviews before the appearance of Ulysses as a whole. That wasn't at all Proust's position as far as his novel was concerned. He had published various essays and he had a certain profile. But it was really in 1919, when he won the Prix Goncourt for the second volume of the Recherche, that his public profile began to grow. A further volume was published before his death, though, as you've said already, it would be 1927 before the work would appear as a whole. And it really is from the early 1920s on, I suppose, that his reputation grows. And he certainly becomes a very important reference point for all kinds of modernist writers. Joyce read him and I think appreciated him and thought a lot about what his work represented. There were points in common, though I think it was important for Joyce in his own mind to clearly to understand how his project was different and why his project mattered in the ways in which it was different. But there was perhaps a greater affinity on the part of a writer like Virginia Woolf, who read Proust closely and for whom I think he was a model. And the other thing worth saying is that a number of important critics began to write about Proust in the 1920s, the German writer Curtius, and very notably Walter Benjamin, who wrote a very important early essay on Proust. So certainly by the time the Recherche was fully published in 1927, he did enjoy an important profile, and not least in Dublin, where, of course, Samuel Beckett taught, and at the time when Samuel Beckett was teaching in Trinity, he was working on his monograph on Proust. And that secured for Proust an early readership in Dublin. You know, Beckett's monograph was mentioned in the Irish Times, so he had a certain local visibility, there's no doubt about that, and all kinds of writers who would go on to be important were exposed to Proust and read Proust.
Max, that brings us very nicely to the Irish Proust and the theme of this wonderful collection of essays. And can you tell me, first of all, how this book came about? Because it started originally as a conference.
That's correct. It was a conference held in MOLLY, the Museum of Literature Ireland, at the end of 2022 to mark the centenary of Proust's death. And it's a project that had started to take shape in my mind a few years before that, stirred by two parallel thoughts. The first was that while Proust never visited this country, and while Ireland was far from being at the centre of his creative consciousness, there were nonetheless traces of Irish culture within his work that merited critical exploration. In his novel, In Search of Lost Time, we encounter allusions to the downfall of Oscar Wilde, whom Proust may or may not have met, and who comes to represent the terrifying prospect of homosexual exposure. That's the theme of Elizabeth Laidenson's chapter in this volume. Norman place names of Irish or putatively Irish origin are discussed in a lengthy monologue about etymologies in the novel. The famous Madeleine episode, where the Madeleine cake dipped in tea triggers the experience of involuntary memory. This episode features imagery that seems to be indirectly shaped by Irish folklore. And one of Proust's notebooks includes a cryptic reference to, I quote, crossbred Irish nobility, end quote, which suggests that he at one time contemplated giving some Irish ancestry to the aristocratic Guermantes family in his novel. What's more, Proust was always absorbed in current affairs. He read up to 7 newspapers per day, including the Irish War of Independence. And so we find in his letters that during 1920 and even as late as 1922, he repeatedly compares himself to Terence McSweeney, the Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork, who died in Brixton Prison in October 1920 after more than 70 days on hunger strike. To give you an example, he wrote to a journalist friend in 1920, having the mayor of Cork's physical weakness prolonged by an odious diet, I have the strength to continue living to finish my book. There's a certain flippancy here, not least given the disparity between the two men's circumstances. Proust often dined at the Ritz Hotel in these years. At the same time, these remarks have a certain poignancy given that Proust habitually ate almost nothing during the later years of his life. And we glimpse through this persistent identification with McSweeney a strong premonition of his own death. As the Proust scholar Françoise Le Riche puts it, In Search of Lost Time is a work nourished by all European culture of its time. It is a cosmopolitan novel, and Ireland has its place, be it discreet, within that fictional universe. Now, the second thought underlying the Irish Proust is that Proust's work had an early and enduring influence on Irish literature and cultural life. as Paddy has just noted in the case of Beckett's early monograph. And this encompasses the work of Elizabeth Bowen, Mary Devonport O'Neill, a largely forgotten Dublin poet of the 1920s, Brendan Behan and John McGahern, all of whom are the subject of chapters in this volume. Proust was studied as studied by undergraduates in the French department at Trinity College Dublin as early as 1926, 4 years after his death, and even before the entirety of his novel had been published in French. More generally, the decades after independence in this country are remembered as a period of austerity, isolation, and clerically enforced cultural conservatism. But there was a lively cosmopolitan and multilingual literary world in this city, centered on salons, little magazines, and universities. And reading Proust, whose work was eventually banned here during the 1940s and 1950s, became a marker of subversive cultural distinction. And this is part of the story we tell in The Irish Proust.
And in your introduction, you mention how in Sally Rooney's novel Normal People, Marianne is reading the first volume. So Proust makes an appearance there as well.
Yes, we glimpse Marianne reading Swan's Way, I think, in the schoolyard towards the beginning of the novel.
And it's interesting as well, you mention how a French president who had Irish descent, he appears in it, and that also seems to be a character who Proust was very interested in.
Yes, this is Patrice de MacMahon, Patrice de MacMahon, you might say, in this country, who was one of the wild geese. He was descended from Catholic gentry in Limerick, who had fled after the Williamite War in the late 17th century, having lost their lands. Many of the MacMahon became soldiers in the French army, including Patrice de MacMahon, who became a marshal. He was the victor at the Battle of Magenta, and he became the second president of the Third Republic during the 1870s. He features on at least two occasions by name in the novel, and his name at first functions as a kind of signifier of absolute social prestige, because he combines this French aristocratic aura with a more mysterious Gaelic noble identity. The second time around, It's actually rather different. By this time he's no longer in power, and indeed the episode seems to happen after his death. Two unnamed characters are sitting in the Bois de Boulogne in Paris, and they see the former courtesan Odette de Crécy, the wife of Swann, going past in a carriage, and one says to the other, "I slept with her on the night that MacMahon resigned," and that seems to mark the end of an era, and it also seems to mark the end of MacMahon's importance in the novel as this signifier of social prestige.
And even the story you tell there's humor clearly then in the book, in the work.
Proust's novel is fundamentally a comic novel. Now the comedy doesn't tend to come in the form of one-liners, but there certainly are jokes, and that the novel's structure is fundamentally comic insofar as, yes, it's largely an unhappy book which is about frustration and heartbreak and betrayal, but it does have this happy redemptive wedding that concludes in what Elizabeth Laidenson calls in her chapter in the book the Proustian version of a marriage, where he vows to write his great book, which is a way of marrying himself.
Barry, you're an acclaimed novelist as well as a distinguished scholar, and I wonder, has Proust been an influence on you when you've been writing, and how do you view him?
Well, I suppose for an Irish writer, he offers a different path than Joyce does. The impact that they had on their relative literary cultures is, you know, very big, but also very different in the sense that Joyce offers really is a technique. He has all registers and styles of English available to him. So Ulysses is a kind of patchwork of different types of English, or English kind of all scrambled up or exploded in ways. Whereas what Proust offers is a style. It's a way of stretching literary language to its limits without breaking it in a way. So in that sense, he offers a I think for writers, Irish writers, a different way of thinking about literary language and a different way of writing. He's also extraordinarily frank about homosexuality, that his novel is full of gay characters. He's very interested in what it means to be gay, what it feels like to be gay, and the kind of social world that he depicts is so far away from the social world that Joyce is depicting. You know, Joyce is interested in a sort of middle-class, respectable, or clinging on to respectable bourgeoisie, whereas Proust is a whole world of the Belle Époque of salons and aristocrats. It's a, you know, it's a completely different world that has a different style attached to it that can be imported to Irish material in a very interesting way, I think.
And your essay on the revivalist Proust shows that he brings a very different model to cultural revival than Joyce or Yeats, and that he's perhaps basing it on literary transformation rather than linguistic nationalism, and that he approaches it in really a quite separate way.
Well, for me, the real difference between Joyce and Proust, or I mean, one of the fundamental ones, is that Joyce was a writer in exile. So he left Ireland when he was very young, and Ireland and Irish life and Irish speech and language had to be called up from a distance in his imagination. And you can see one of the results of this is that Ulysses takes place over the course of a single day. So it's, you know, a single kind of freeze frame. It's like a kind of a snapshot. Whereas Proust's novel takes place over a lifetime, you know, many, many, many decades. Because Proust was a writer who stayed at home. He very rarely left France, just a couple of trips to Venice. He was a homeboy who lived really not just in Paris, but in a neighborhood attached to his family. And so for him to get outside his society, to kind of be able to see it with a writer's eye, he had to find other ways of going into exile, if you like, from at home. And one of these he found was through what he called a Celtic belief, whereby the ghosts of the past or the spirits of the past were wont to suddenly appear in flashes like ghosts before you. And I think this is it is a real difference. You know, Joyce captures what it's like to be in a city in one day. People have fixed identities in Ulysses. You know, if you were a miser on the 16th of June 1904, you're forever the kind of the allegory, the symbol of the miser in Ulysses. Whereas in Proust's novel, characters change. Nobody ends the novel the way they begin it. If you are the characters turn out to be gay, but the most vulgar woman in Paris becomes the most elevated aristocrat, and so on. So it's a very different experience of life, I think. One lived at home in the city where he was from, where as he was growing older himself, Proust saw people change around him. And this is reflected in the novel. Whereas for Joyce, living abroad, Dublin was kind of cast into this eternal snapshot in his mind.
Richard, we could spend the entire show discussing these great concepts of time, memory, and loss that appear and reoccur in the work. And it's incredible the different techniques and elements that he incorporates. The idea of involuntary memory that we've mentioned, time being a destroyer, the idea of giants immersed in time, that there are so many of these elements that shape and are fundamental to the work.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I mean, I think everybody knows about involuntary memory, and it can become a bit of a cliche, but it's worth kind of looking at that initial kind of Madeleine moment, the kind of the way in which Proust describes that, this identical moment. So you have a moment in the present, which is identical to the moment in the past. And from that, the vast structure of recollection, it takes a kind of solidity, like pieces of paper in a porcelain bowl becoming solid, as in kind of a Japanese kind of game. So, in that sense, we kind of regain lost time. This lost time comes back to us, but of course that is reliant on our forgetting it in the first place. And this is where this kind of transcendent moment, we need to also give due credence to the boring routinization of life, of habit. That's something that Beckett really emphasized in his early work on Proust. And I think a line such as habit is a great deadener. I think it's Vladimir in Waiting for Godot. I don't think that we'd have that line in Waiting for Godot without Beckett's reading of Proust. Another example of the famous involuntary memory is the notion of the intermittences of the heart. And Marcel's grandmother has died. This maybe hasn't really registered. And it's just when he's bending over to take off a boot that it all comes back to me again, the identical moment of distress and loneliness. What's interesting about that grandmother intermittence of the heart is that he has an affective response. His heart swells. He feels it physically, somatically, before understanding what it is. Ah, my grandmother is dead. You know, I had just learned she was dead, even though she died a year ago or something. He makes a point that the calendar of facts do not coincide with that of our feelings. You could just say it's a delayed reaction, but it's a little bit more than that. It's our own experience of loss and of time. And so by the final volume, Time Regained, we get into some difficult but key language about Proustian essence. And I'll just quote this phrase. It's all stayed with me. I wouldn't be able to necessarily explicate it very well, but let's have a think about that. That we have that kind of sensory transport through smell or taste rather than sight too dominant. But that moment, real in the present and in the past, Proust describes as being real without being actual. And the word actuel in French, so present and material. But real without being actual, ideal without being abstract. So we get to a key moment in the last volume where we step outside of time. It is time regained, but it's also this extratemporal idea of eternity, and that is art. I'll read another phrase from Time Regained. I had made the discovery, Marcel, of this destructive action of time at the very moment when I had conceived the ambition to make visible, to intellectualize in a work of art, realities that were outside time. So Proust is a great writer of time and of memory, of course, and the richness and recuperation of memory. But in the end, his art is sort of bidding, and it's a classic kind of immortality of art, the eternal art that is outside time. But being so clever, he knows that artists die and their artworks can be forgotten as well. So it's not an easy out, the immortality of art. He considers the painting of Vermeer and the patch of yellow in the Vermeer canvas. Will this last? Will great art last? So that becomes obviously wrapped up in his own great project.
Well, tonight we are talking about Proust and exploring the Irish Proust as we go in search of lost time. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be finding out why Proust was censored in Ireland in the 1940s and why only some of his work was censored. That's coming up right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Marcel Proust and going in search of lost time. My brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Max McGuinness, who's a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of French at Trinity College Dublin, and the co-editor with Michael Cronin of the brilliant new book, The Irish Proust, Cultural Crossings from Beckett to McGahern, and he's also the theatre critic for the Irish Times. Professor Patrick O'Donovan is Emeritus Professor of French at University College Cork and a leading scholar of French literature and thought. taught with a particular interest in Proust and modernity, and he was the founding chairperson of the Irish Humanities Alliance. Professor Barry McRae is the Donald R. Keogh Family Professor of Irish Studies and Professor of English, Irish Language and Literature at the University of Notre Dame, as well as a distinguished novelist and scholar of comparative literature. And we're also delighted to be joined by Dr. Richard Robinson, Associate Professor at Swansea University, whose work focuses on modernism, contemporary fiction and the history of literary style, and he's also the founding director of the Creative and Critical Practice Research Group, and his books include John McGahern and Modernism. Max, can we talk about the censorship question and the way some of Proust's work is censored during the Second World War in Ireland? And that surprised me. First, that it had taken so long for them to get around to it, but also that they didn't just censor all of it if it was problematic.
So let's go back to April 1943. I think the Battle of the Atlantic is at its zenith. The Soviets and the Nazis are engaged in a titanic struggle in the Eastern Front. In this country, the authorities have something else on their minds, which is Marcel Proust. In 1943, the Minister for Justice issued prohibition orders against the final four volumes of the 12-volume English translation, and this followed recommendations from the Censorship of Publications Board. What's unusual about this is two things. The first is that these volumes were banned 12 years after they had been published, after the English translation of Proust had appeared, after the final volume had appeared. The second thing is that they only ban four out of the 12 volumes, the final four volumes, and they notably fail to ban the volume entitled Sodom et Gomorrah in French, which was then published under the slightly less alarming title Cities of the Plain. And what this suggests is the fundamentally haphazard character of Irish censorship. The censors really weren't reading the books that they banned. In that year alone, I think over 100 books were banned, and that was typical for the 1940s. That level of censoring work is not one that the censors were able to do diligently. And a few years later, a senator, T.C. Kingsmill Moore, the senator for Dublin University, who later became a Supreme Court judge. He came to Proust's defense in the Shannon, and here is what he said. He said, "There has been published recently a novel which no responsible critic, of whom I am aware, ranks lower than amongst the six greatest novels ever written, which most would class amongst the first three, and which many would put at the top. I refer to Proust's work, The Remembrance of Things Past. Here again, we find that certain of the books of Proust in that series appear in the Register of Prohibited Publications." Now, the man responsible for banning Proust was the chairman of the Censorship Board, Professor William McGuinness. He was also a senator, and he was sitting there in the chamber with T.C. Kingsmill Moore. He made no attempt to justify the decision to censor Proust in response to this speech made by Kingsmill Moore. Another feature of the Irish censorship regime is that in almost all cases, foreign books were only banned in translation. And this was also true of Proust. So this didn't, this meant that points of what Michael Cronin calls in the book amphibian passage for foreign works of literature were not closed off. And those points of amphibian passage were modern language departments constituting a kind of domestic foreign space within this country. Those with sufficient facility in foreign languages could continue to read scandalous works of literature in the original language. And this was happening. Proust, as I think I've already noted, was taught in Trinity from the 1920s onwards. This is where Samuel Beckett first encountered his work as an undergraduate in the mid-1920s. And that formation within modern languages within Trinity was essential to his development as the multilingual, self-translating writer that he became. The same is true of Joyce, by the way, who studied French and Italian at University College Dublin. The modern languages in this country played a central role in the development of Irish modernism. And this is a phenomenon that Fidus Gaffney, who has appeared on the show before, analyzes extensively in her book Foreign Tongues about the history of modern language education in this country, which was always particularly extensive and particularly influential.
And it is, as I've said, a wonderful collection of essays and a wonderful foreword by our ambassador in Paris, Niall Burgess. And the remarkable connection between Proust and the architect of the Irish embassy in Paris. And again, it shows these connections, sometimes obvious, sometimes not so obvious, between Ireland and Proust.
Yes, so the Irish embassy in Paris has been located since 1954 in the Hôtel de Breteuil on the Avenue Foch, which was previously known as the Avenue du Bois de Boulogne. And this is a magnificent townhouse that was built in the late 19th century by a French aristocrat, the Marquis de Breteuil. And Proust knew the Marquis de Breteuil. Not only did he know him, Breteuil became a model for one of the characters in his novel, Annibal de Bréauté. So Niall Burgess, our ambassador in France, was happy to contribute a foreword about the history of this building and its Proustian associations, which begins the volume.
Paddy, can we talk about Proust's writing room? Because you write about that so well in this collection of essays, and how significant it is in terms of how he approaches maybe some of the major themes, the idea of a cork-lined bedroom where these identities and memories are transformed and reborn.
Well, as I said earlier, Proust, when his parents passed away, he then began to live at an advanced enough age, a fully independent life, and quickly enough hit on the idea of the novel and over quite a compressed period of time dived into it, began to plan it, and began then to draft it, and engaged in this period of intense work between 1907 and start of the war in 1914. And yes, he rented an apartment, quite a large apartment, in the Boulevard Haussmann, where he lived almost then to the end of his life. Initially, he envisaged leading a more conventional life there, receiving people and so on, and having a study in one of the salons in that setting. But his state of health was such that he began to retreat to his bedroom. His habits of sleep were never very regular. So increasingly, he slept by day, worked by night. It wasn't an ideal choice of habitat. He chose that house because it was known to his mother. And when his mother died, he struggled with the idea of living somewhere she hadn't known. But it was on a very busy thoroughfare. It was difficult to escape dust and pests of the sort that would trigger his asthma. And it was a noisy building internally and externally. Recently, letters he exchanged with a neighbour upstairs have come to light, where he vividly describes how he was plagued by noise by day when he was trying to sleep. But yes, Proust was in the happy position that he had the means to live independently. He gave himself entirely to his work and simply plugged away until almost to the day, until the very day of his death, working and revising his novel, not venturing out much, though his social life did resume you know, late in the war, when he became friendly with an earlier generation of writers. The room assumed a kind of mythological status from the publication of Du Côté de chez Swann in 1913, because Proust was interviewed by various newspapers. Journalists came to his apartment and described its dark, murky gloom. Proust wrote in notebooks because that was the easiest platform on which to write when he was lying in bed. These piled up around him, and there he was, installed there for all that time. He did have an extraordinary meeting in May 1921 with many of the most important figures of the modernist movement, Picasso, Stravinsky, and Joyce, in the Hotel Majestic, not very far from where he lived. And he got a taxi home at the end of a long evening, and Joyce was a passenger in the taxi. And there is a piquant moment where Joyce had heard of this legendary flat and was quite interested in seeing it. And when they all descended from the taxi, he made as if to do so. But Proust wasn't very interested in having Joyce, resuming his conversation with Joyce, and sent him on his way in the taxi. So that was, a meeting of two writers, but not at the time a meeting of minds. And as I say, he worked away there with the indispensable help of a woman whom he took on as his housekeeper and eventually his secretary, Céleste Albaré. He became more and more dependent on her. He often depended on her to take dictation. Some of the letters that were dispatched in Proust's name were drafted by her. And she hit on the remarkable idea of using little pieces of paper and glue, which she attached to his notebooks, so that Proust could redraft passages he'd already written, make additions to them. Proust was a great writer of additions, of expansions, of new components, of variations on what he'd already written. And she had a seminal role at a certain point, in that when he was struggling to try to keep track of all of this material and make sure that the right edition was associated with the right original component, as I say, she hit on the idea of using small or large pieces of paper in which he would incorporate the new material, and then these were glued in place. So she was a decisive influence in this and all kinds of other ways.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, work and legacy of Marcel Proust and the incredible connections with Ireland. And we're going to find out about his influence on the writer John McGarren right after this break. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we are going in search of lost time as we find out about Proust and Irish connections. And it's based around the publication of a brilliant new collection of essays, The Irish Proust, Cultural Crossings from Beckett to McGarren. Our brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Max McGuinness, who's a postdoctoral fellow at the Department of French at Trinity College Dublin and the co-editor of that collection, Professor Patrick O'Donovan, who is one of the contributors to the volume and emeritus professor of French at University College Cork, Professor Barry McRae, who's the Donald R. Keogh Family Professor of Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame, as well as a novelist and scholar, and again, one of the contributors to the volume, and Dr. Richard Robinson, Associate Professor at Swansea University in the Department of Literature, Media and Languages, and the founding director of the Creative and Critical Practice Research Group, and his books include John McGarren and Modernism. And Richard, can we talk to you about your essay in the volume about Proust and John McGarren and the very interesting connection between the two writers?
Yes, of course. And I'd like to start off with, I think many readers of McGarren know that as a boy, he lost his beloved mother, and this stayed with him for his whole life and his whole writing life. And this must have, when he first read Proust in translation in the 50s, the first scene is about the symbolic loss of the mother, who goes back downstairs and abandons the boy in his bedroom, this drame de coucher, this drama of sleeping. And he would have responded to that. And then, as panelists have already pointed out, the cycle of loss, the loss of the grandmother that I was talking about earlier, but there's many characters in the Recherche die, and he thinks about them. And in Proust, he would have read that, as Marcel says, a writer's work, like the water in an artesian well, and I love that metaphor, mount to a height which is in proportion to the depth to which suffering has penetrated his soul. So this suffering, experienced suffering, can create great art. It's going to spout out of the well. You drill down into the moi profond, the deep depths of self. It's very much kind of, that's the metaphor of depths, going down into depths, such as the Orphic depths. Depths, you lose, you have to lose again, as Orpheus lost Eurydice, and that enables great art. That's what McGann, one of the things that he got from Proust. You see kind of moments in the short stories which are fairly expedient uses of involuntary memory. There's a short story called The Wine Breath, which confusingly is a quotation from a Yeats poem, in which a man sees some beach chips catching the sunlight, and this blinding light, an old priest says, takes him back to the snowbound winter of 1947 and the memories of somebody there. So it's very clearly an instance of involuntary memory. In an essay called The Image, the language is Proustian. He's the search for the image, the grave of the images of dead passions and their days, image after image, flows involuntarily now, McGahan writes. And we have a book like The Leave Taking, in which a school teacher stumbles on the lost day, the dead day, in Proust. Stumbling on a stone is yet another example of involuntary memory, that stumble. So the character stumbles through time. And another thing I'd just like to say about kind of the time writing, so we have McGahan as a great writer of memory and recovery. We should kind of pay attention to the Proustian sentence. Occasionally in McGahan, you have this idea, and the great Proust scholar Malcolm Bowie talks about it, that Proust's subject may be time, but it's enacted in the very grammar and syntax of these long, convoluted sentences that split off and fling us forward and take us back. So the reader experiences time in the very syntax of a Proustian sentence. And McGahan maybe doesn't do that a lot, but at the end of a story called All Sorts of Impossible Things, he does do that. It's very much a long set-piece sentence where we have hypothetical futures that are impossible, lost time, and it's all hinged in the proliferating, bifurcating syntax of the sentence. And finally, the book memoir that I write about in Max and Michael's book, I sort of thought, well, Proust's name never appears in memoir, but he's everywhere in it. And at the end, the famous ending of McGahan's memoir, we have Sean McGahan walking the lanes of Leitrim as a 70-something older man, and remembering doing so with his mother at 3 or 4. And this is very much framed in this kind of final volume of Proust. Time regained, but then you're stepping outside of time. You're freed from the order of time. I would pick the flowers. So it's a kind of eternal realm of art that kind of leads to the affective power of the end, of the last paragraphs of McGahan's memoir.
Max, where do you think Proust stands today in the 21st century in terms of his legacy, in terms of his reputation, in terms of, I suppose, his critical reputation, but also his reputation in more popularly?
The writer and critic Edmund White used to say that Proust and Joyce were locked in a contest for the title of greatest novelist of the 20th century. White incidentally added that he thought Proust was winning. And his critical reputation remains extremely high. He's the subject of extensive scholarship, particularly in France, where there is this major endeavor which involves publishing diplomatic transcriptions of all of Proust's manuscripts. That was incidentally led by Nathalie Mauriac-Dyer, who has contributed a chapter on Proust and Beckett to this volume, The Irish Proust. More generally, Proust, his recherche is a difficult book. It's a long book, and it's hard, But it still attracts a general readership. I'm always surprised by the extent to which people will attend lectures or talks about Proust, and he does generate a certain kind of obsession. There are people who seem to devote their whole lives to him. It remains a work that is an inexhaustible font of potential inspiration and a way of reading into yourself. This is an idea that is expressed right at the end of the book, that this book itself is ultimately an instrument that will allow the reader to find out about who they are. Proust wrote it quite quickly, so you can read it quickly. Roland Barthes once joked that one never skips over the same passages twice in Proust when rereading him, and it can be read in that spirit. It's both a book about the experience of memory, of dwelling in the past, as well as a book about technological modernity, about speed, which features, for instance, aeroplanes. It features the advent of the motor car. He is confronting the modern world as it rushes towards him.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. The new collection of essays is called The Irish Proust Cultural Crossings from Beckett to McGarren, edited by Michael Cronin and Max McGuinness. And my thanks to my wonderful panel of experts for bringing the life, work, legacy and influence of Proust to us tonight. Dr. Max McGuinness, who's postdoctoral fellow in the Department of French at Trinity College Dublin and the theatre critic of the Irish Times. Professor Paddy O'Donovan, Patrick O'Donovan, Emeritus Professor of French at University College Cork, who's a leading scholar of French literature and thought. Professor Barry McRae, who's the Donald R. Keogh Family Professor of Irish Studies and Professor of English, Irish Language and Literature at the University of Notre Dame, as well as a distinguished novelist and scholar of comparative literature. And Dr. Richard Robinson, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Literature, Media and Language at Swansea University and the founding director of the Creative and Critical Practice Research Group, and whose books include John McGahern and Modernism. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan for bringing everything together. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.